The following recording is a production of Critical Studies in Media Communication, a publication of the National Communication Association and distributed by Taylor & Francis under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-Alike license. For more information about this audio recording and Critical Studies in Media Communication, please visit Taylor & Francis at www.tandfonline.com. This interview is in two parts. You are listening to part two. To find part one, please return to the podcast feed where you downloaded this file, or visit the Critical Studies in Media Communication website at www.tandfonline.com.
So let's get to this life cycle model, which is essentially explaining what it takes to succeed as a pop star today. It has a series of kind of phases and stages. So maybe walk me through this.
Sure. So what typically happens, and again, this is for people who succeed at the highest level of the industry. You can enter in different ways, but usually you don't have much longevity if you do that. So ordinarily, people enter in a phase called the good girl, which is where you represent sort of as the girl next door. And this is going to look different depending on your age when you enter, right? You might look like Leanne Rimes at age 15, or you might look at like Whitney Houston when she entered the industry, or you might look like Taylor Swift when she entered the industry. So it's going to vary depending on what your genre of origin is, what your age is, but it's pretty much going to be a very wholesome look, the girl next door, she's sweet, she sings like a songbird, so on and so forth. Very quickly what happens, and this often happens when people are brought to market young, like when they're underage, not under the age of consent, literally, is they will come to market as the good girl, Britney Spears in the Catholic schoolgirl kind of uniform, and then very quickly as she sort of reaches the age of consent, transition into this phase called temptress, which is where the clothes start falling off. People are dressing more provocatively, lyrics are more provocative. The overall representation is just much more about sort of sex, sexual availability, and so on and so forth. So very few stars are able to escape the good girl phase and the temptress phase. Pretty much everybody goes through that. And from there, the model becomes a little bit more complicated, and you track according to really how people are receiving you. So if you're Whitney Houston, or if you're Adele now, people are talking about your voice, right? That your voice is legendary. So in the diva category, that means usually we're talking about your music more than we're talking about your clothes or your boyfriends or what you just did at that VMA performance, okay? It's the most enviable position in the model. But you could just as well do something like Miley Cyrus did at the VMAs and move into a category called the hot mess. Right? And again, I should back up and say that the terminology I'm using in here is all language that came from my respondents, my music industry respondents. And, you know, some people might have sanitized that, right, to be sort of more academic, but I thought it was really important to preserve the language of the industry because this is the way in which these artists are talked about and managed, and I think it's important to preserve that. But these aren't my words when I'm referring to people as hot messes. And of course, the hot mess is complicated because in some cases there are horrible things going on in people's personal lives, which is sort of driving them to these misbehaviors in public and so on and so forth. Apart from the diva and the hot mess, there are four other categories that sort of represent the middle section of the life cycle for female popular music stars. Then we move into a third phase. So as we move through the phases, it becomes increasingly less likely that you're going to succeed, right? So many, many people make it through Good Girl and Temptress. Some people make it successfully into one of these middle categories. And then we have sort of a third and fourth stage. The third phase is interesting because it generally says that if you're connected to an incredibly powerful man in the industry, you might achieve an area of protected status, right? Which means that you can insulate yourself from some of the you know, sort of indecencies of the industry. So with someone like Whitney Houston, that would have been Clive Davis, her record label president, who was really trying to make sure that she had every opportunity to come back and things like that. In other cases, it may be someone you're married to. You could argue in this, you know, sort of time that Beyonce might be protected in some way by having, you know, her husband as, you know, Jay-Z. The other thing that you can do once you've achieved a certain level of success is you can sort of put yourself in what I call self-imposed exile, which would look like Celine Dion deciding to play Las Vegas ad infinitum. Okay, so sort of taking herself out of the mix, but still sort of having a singing career where it's very focused. It's in one area. She doesn't have a lot of sort of competition, not in the same way that you do when you put yourself more thoroughly in the mix. Then, for people who really, 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 you know, make it, you can achieve legendary status. Someone like Whitney Houston, I would say, certainly has done that in a number of different ways. Someone like Madonna has certainly done that. And what is interesting is, the more I studied this, I realized that there are two opportunities for people to either achieve, you know, legendary status yet still start over again in the life cycle model, or, you know, come out of one of the third stage phases and start over again as good girl. And Madonna actually laps the model. Madonna actually starts over again at good girl. When she's in her 40s, she comes out with this sort of, you know, country manner Madonna, you know, with her tweed coats and elbow patches, and then quickly transitions into temptress again with Confessions on a Dance Floor. Okay, so she literally laps the model and starts over again, which I think is hilarious in and of itself, and good for her, right?
Triumphant.
She's triumphant is exactly the right word. Hilariously triumphant. And then Christina Aguilera also does it. Christina Aguilera goes through sort of a rocky period with Dirty. Her sales are really good, but the public backlash is intense, right? And she, you know, becomes a bit of a gay icon for a while, another one of these third stage categories, but there's a lot of dissonance around her. But in Madonna's case, what she did is she had a child and she publicly discovered religion. That was her sort of redemption loop back to the beginning. Christina Aguilera was having a child, right? So the two things you can do if there is sort of some rockiness in your career to be rehabbed in the public's mind, and again, for very complicated sociological reasons, are you can have a child or you can publicly discover religion. So Christina Aguilera comes back to the beginning of the life cycle model and then gets rebirthed herself as this maternal figure who can then go on The Voice and coach other people in a very maternal fashion. So she moves away from being, you know, in a lot of cases, constructed as being a chilly sort of diva to being this very maternal, very likable character that she had never been before.
Given the life cycle model, maybe could we just take one person and kind of map a little bit? I was thinking perhaps Whitney Houston would be a good one to go with.
Sure. She's interesting and complicated for a number of different reasons. I would say Whitney absolutely started in the good girl mold, right? Whitney got her start singing in church. You know, she came up in her church choir. That's the whole narrative there. And she is represented as a good girl from head to toe, you know. And what I learned in my interviews is that that was never, ever, ever the case. So a lot of people would tell the Whitney Houston story of she was this, you know, flawless, amazing, perfect, you know, angel. And then she met Bobby Brown and her life fell apart. From what I hear from my industry respondents is that's not the case at all. Like, if you had met Whitney Houston at the beginning, you would say Bobby Brown is her perfect life partner kind of thing. So a lot of this was constructed, right? And the reason I mention that is I think when we're branding, it's very important to build a brand that a person can live inside rather than building, you know, such a fiction that any deviation from it is seen as hypocritical, and then the artist really sort of takes the flack for not living up to who they're supposed to be, right? So I find her case particularly upsetting in that respect. So she then moves on. Her temptress phase isn't long, and it certainly isn't as pronounced as, you know, someone like Christina Aguilera's, but I think that's because it's clear that Whitney Houston is heading to that diva category, right? She has a best-in-class voice. You know, she is truly legendary. She will live on being remembered for her voice above everything else. But, as we know, Whitney had a lot of sort of public trials and tribulations, too. She had, again, the protected status of Clive Davis, but she also had, you know, a husband, Bobby Brown, who had been in the industry, and her interaction with him, in a lot of ways, complicated her public image. So Clive Davis is trying to rehab her career, but at the same time, she's appearing in a reality show being Bobby Brown, which is not casting her in the best light, is making people sort of question her as a mother and things like that, something that, you know, sociologically is horrifying, right, if you're a public figure. And then she starts sort of battling with drugs. She had a couple of battles with drugs, but we start to sort of see representations of that. So Whitney sort of enters, even though she's got the protected status and she's a diva, she sort of transitions into this hot mess kind of category, right? And the hot mess, again, is just a representative of bad behavior in public that people see and they sort of laugh at because it looks, you know, ridiculous. But a lot of times addiction or something like that is what's operating behind the scenes. And unfortunately, we know how this story ends. Like, Whitney Houston does die as a legend, but she dies as, you know, sort of a bit of a compromised legend. You know, she had this great career, this great voice. It would be great if everybody could just say, Whitney Houston had one of the best voices we've ever heard, the end. But it was much more complicated than that. So she really did interact with different phases of the model.
Could we maybe walk through a little bit of the life cycle model for Lady Gaga and think about it as a beautiful failure, perhaps?
Sure, sure.
Or a compelling failure.
Sure.
Not always so beautiful.
Yeah. So Lady Gaga has a very interesting backstory. So she begins as Stephanie Germanotta, and you can find videos of her on YouTube performing at an NYU talent contest. And there she's, a fairly, you know, sort of plain-looking woman with long brown hair performing in her bare feet. Certainly this is not some costumed spectacle. She sounds much more like a Fiona Apple or a Tori Amos as she plays, and you think, wow, this is a super talented musician. Like, she's great. So she gets signed to a major label, and she gets dropped 3 months later. And she sort of goes back, you know, to a number of different people. They start to create this sort of Lady Gaga character. She comes back to market, gets signed as Lady Gaga, and then begins the Lady Gaga as we know her, you know, career. So I would say that her good girl phase is really when she's Stephanie Germanotta, right? And she's sort of transitioning into Lady Gaga. She hits the market as Lady Gaga. And what's interesting about her and some of the people who come out farther away from the beginning of MTV is that rather than doing it like Madonna did, which is sort of this linear progression through the different phases, Lady Gaga hits the market and is in like five simultaneously. So what I argue in the book is that because she's in five simultaneously and they tend to be in the mid-range of the career, I don't think she's going to have a very long career. And I would stick to that position. So Lady Gaga enters in this sort of temptress position. But again, it's more like a Cyndi Lauper thing where, you know, she's almost in drag in some way. You know, she has costume upon costume, and we're also focused on that. So we really can't sort of deconstruct her looks in the way that other female pop stars sort of take that scrutiny because they put themselves out there sort of more, you know, as themselves. She very quickly becomes a gay icon, right? Because she's, I think really what is critical about her in the early stages is that she develops a narrative that's resonant. And it's certainly resonant with a gay audience because it's basically saying, you know, I don't fit in. There are all kinds of things about me that make me different. If I can be celebrated when I'm wearing my Kermit dress or when I'm stepping out of some sort of egg enclosure or, you know, when I'm doing any number of things, like whatever you have about you that makes you different, it's really not that prohibitive. Okay, right. So just let it fly. Let the freak flag fly. Doesn't my version of reality look like more fun than George Bush's, right? Because remember, you know, she's sort of getting her start, you know, back in 2008, 2009. And so we're coming, you know, at a cultural time out of this very sort of restrictive moment. And she's sort of like, no, it's more fun this way. So there are more outsiders than insiders in anything, really. So more people are going to feel like they don't fit in than do. And so she's sort of appealing to that group, which is why she's able to bring so many people into her brand. So she sort of continues on in this sort of temptress, sometimes sort of whore. That's another one of the categories where, like, everything becomes about either making money or sex. There are sort of two poles to the whore category. The hot mess category, certainly, when she announces that she has a fragrance that is made out of blood and semen, I would put her in the hot mess category. Many, many things she did would sort of situate her there. So she's simultaneously temptress and hot mess and icon and whore, and she's just tearing through the phases of the life cycle model in rapid succession. And guess what? You know, like, if we say that her career begins sometime in 2008, and ends, you know, sometime like at the end of 2013, that's her run. You know, she had an epic run at the top of everything. I mean, amazing. But this is where the short-term person brand thing becomes important. If someone said at the beginning of this, if you're going to base your whole shtick on provocation, it can't last. Okay, you're going to run out of things that you can do. So we're going to build you as a short-term brand, and we're going to kill it for 5 years. And then we're going to either have you make a lateral move into fashion, because that seems to be what you're really interested in, fashion or art in some way. Or at the end of this, we're going to sort of strip you back down to Stephanie Germanotta and say, listen, little monsters, I've been telling you that you should feel free to be yourself. I haven't really been myself. This is me as myself. La, la, la. You know, and then people get to see that amazing artist again.
Right.
So I think her story is very telling. And I think it was a terrific success, as long as the parameters were, we want you to kill it for 5 years. If the parameters were, we want you to be a career artist, then they didn't kill it, because I think her career is really on the skids right now.
So one of the areas in this book that I thought was fascinating was an example of someone who doesn't fit this model at all and has kind of gone in a different direction in her career is Linda Perry. And I'm wondering if you could map out a little bit of the challenges for someone who does not fit this model and can't kind of find a space in it.
Sure. So Linda Perry was the front woman for Four Non Blondes, and they had a song that everybody would recognize, and I am not going to sing it here, but it's called What's Up, and if we could insert like 10 seconds, it would be hilarious. But basically, the thing that's I think a little bit strange about this for me is that she wrote the song, she performed the song, she demonstrated that she could have a major hit with a song, and yet, when I talk to respondents about, why don't we hear more pop songs from Linda Perry that she performs herself, why does Linda Perry go on to write Beautiful and hand it over to Christina Aguilera? Why does she write songs for Pink? Why is she not performing these songs? Why is she handing them over? And basically, what my respondent said to me is that many of these artists who don't sort of have the cookie cutter Maxim profile type looks for female pop stars, the looks that we've come to expect, end up moving into the background as songwriters because they know that their songs are going to travel better, have more resonance, achieve better sales, and so on and so forth if they're performed by someone else. So I asked the question, this became sort of fascinating to me in a really sad way, and I said, well, you know, what would happen if an artist who was not, you know, conventionally attractive in music industry terms wrote the best song that you had ever heard? Like, what would you advise, you know, if you were their publicist or their manager or their record label executive, and they said, you sell the song. Everybody said it. Like, it was like almost like, silly girl, you sell the song, you know, kind of thing. And I thought, wow, that's horrifying, right? If you port that thinking into any other profession, you know, like, oh, you create a great class, like, you're not hot enough to teach that class. We're going to give it to somebody else, right? I mean, it's horrifying, but in the music industry, it's like second nature. Oh, well, so, well, I mean, you're not Christina Aguilera. You can't perform a song Beautiful, which is all about how you're beautiful from the inside and you're beautiful no matter what anybody says. And so I'm thinking, why doesn't Linda Perry get to sing that song? And she did. She made a recording of the song, so she does perform the song, but obviously it becomes a gigantic hit with Christina Aguilera. And, you know, maybe she wanted that. You know, maybe she said, I'd like to perform this song, but I know if I give this song to one of the strongest sort of stars in the universe at this point, my message gets out there, and maybe that was important to her. I don't know the specifics of that situation, but I do know if she's writing these hits for Christina Aguilera and Pink, and that she's performed something that was so deeply resonant, like, I would like for there to be space for her to perform her own songs and be received in the same way that Christina Aguilera might when she performs a song.
At the end of the book, you offer some rays of hope. People like Adele and such, that's very nice. Is that just a kind of moment of positivity in what, you know, is incredibly compelling but also aggravating and frustrating? But I'm wondering if that's where you're going next with your work, or, you know, what is next for you?
Sure. So I wanted to provide those rays of hope because I am completely aware of how relentlessly depressing my book is, right? And I wanted to capture the reality of the industry at this point in time, but I also hope that it doesn't remain this way for long. So I think it's really important to show it for what it is, but I also, you know, did not want to be Debbie Downer with no hope for the future, right? So I think where my work is going, I have a couple of things I'm interested in right now, but I would like to focus more on those indie stars that I was talking about earlier, those people who don't have the sales of the, you know, dominant female pop stars, but do have real sort of identities as performers. And they're known more for their artistry than for their looks or for their public performances and things like this. So I would like to look at a number of people, maybe like 8 to 10 different people, who have managed to have very successful careers in the music industry, but at a different level, where they're able to sort of accentuate their musicianship, their vocals, so on and so forth, rather than these other things that circulate around them. So I would like to write a book about that, and I would like to write it in a way that sort of shows the pieces that they bring together, the pieces of themselves in some sense that they elect to sell, rather than sort of putting themselves in the thick of competition, which is sort of this hot body show type arena. The second thing that is becoming fascinating to me, and this probably isn't a book, this is probably an article or a book chapter, but I've noticed that the male gaze at this point in time seems so relentless that now it's not quite enough to have a female pop star near naked performing sex acts on stage. Now she needs to be joined by another female pop star, and they need to be engaging in these things together, Shakira and Rihanna style. So this sort of idea about sort of the good girl transitioning into the temptress and then in some way transitioning into a false performance of bisexuality or, you know, lesbian performance, when that is not in the artist's narrative at all. So in other words, there's this whole idea that these women come together for this performance, and then afterwards, you know, in the most recent example with Shakira and Rihanna, Shakira says, oh, well, the only reason I was acting that way toward her in the video is because I have a jealous boyfriend and he won't let me be in videos with men anymore. Okay, that's obviously not what's going on there. It's sort of the male gaze intensified and now we need these women naked in combination. But I'm seeing so much of that, and so much of it where after the fact the performance is disclaimed. So it isn't like, yeah, I'm a gay rights activist and that's why I brought this sort of into my narrative. It's always sort of, oh, well, we decided to do it as a fantasy because, you know, that gives me more distance from it.
Right. That sounds like I Kissed a Girl, right?
Yeah, it's exactly like I Kissed a Girl, and I almost went into it. I'm happy you brought it up because, you know, Katy Perry kissed a girl and she liked it, and that's the whole narrative of the song, but it doesn't mean she's in love tonight. Doesn't mean I'm going to remember your name. And then at the end of the horrifying video, she wakes up next to her boyfriend in bed and it's all been a dream, right?
She's actually telling the narrative to her boyfriend that she kissed a girl.
That's right, and that's what this is all about. And so I find this is a problematic trend, and I would like to sort of blow the whistle on that as well.
I want to thank you so much for a great interview. This was really fun and interesting, and I feel like we should go out with a song. Do you have a song? But maybe we'll save people from that terrible experience.
Maybe we will. Thank you very much.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, yeah, yeah. I said, hey, what's going on?
Yes.